Welcome to the Free Kiwis podcast. We're very delighted today to have Jacob Mchangama with us. Jacob has written a book about free speech, and we'd like to discuss some of the issues he raises in it. So, I mean, one of the things that struck me, Jacob, when I was reading your book was the way in which there's been a sort of uneven progression of through history in terms of orientation to free speech. So James and I were talking before about whether we could see your book as endorsing a kind of view that things are generally getting better over time, albeit with a lot of ups and downs, or whether free speech and the other kind of civic rights that come with it is something that just arises at a certain time and then falls away again. And you have this fascinating concept of free speech entropy. And I think that, you know, talking about that could be a good way to start today.
Yeah, so, you know, I originate the origins of free speech with the Athenian democracy, and that has a good run. And then, you know, aspects of free speech is also part of Roman republicanism, though I would argue a much more elitist top-down version of free speech than sort of the more egalitarian for its day Athenian version. But then, you know, there's quite a long run where free speech is not prominent, even if it'd be wrong to look at the Middle Ages as sort of the Dark Ages. There's lots of really interesting, important developments going on there. But you don't have a concept of free and equal speech in the Middle Ages like you had in the Athenian democracy. So I don't think that you could sort of say that there's an inevitable process of where free speech is sort of in the ascendancy. And you could find lots of moments. So, you know, where free speech is under pressure. So, you know, we think of the Enlightenment as sort of, this is really where you get the breakthrough of free speech. But then, you know, along comes the French Revolution. You have a huge counter-reaction. And then sort of in the years after the Napoleonic Wars, it's really church and altar and censorship for most part of the 19th century in most parts of Europe.
So one of the ways in which these sort of slipping backs from free speech seem to occur is what Michael and I have started talking about is flip-flopping. You get this people who really are demanding free speech because they're kind of being persecuted. And then once they get into a position of not only safety, but sometimes kind of predominance, they then are the first to turn around and start to persecute other people and try and shut down their free speech. And I think you have several examples of this in your book. I mean, maybe Martin Luther is one who, you know, he has to stand up against the might of the Catholic Church, and that's very admirable. But then, of course, he himself writes these tracts against the Jews. And yeah, to what extent do you think this flip-flopping is a big theme in history?
No, I think it's absolutely essential. It's what I call Milton's curse after the English poet John Milton, who wrote the Areopagitica, where he protests the reintroduction of pre-publication censorship. And it's a very eloquent tract, still influential today, but when you read it carefully, it's quite clear that he doesn't mean press freedom for Catholics or it's basically free speech for mainline Protestant sects, right? You know, not anyone who's a radical. And I think that just goes throughout the history of free speech. And it's probably something to do with human psychology and our sort of tribalist instincts. And it's very difficult for the human brain, psyche, our makeup as a species to accept. You know, free speech becomes very concrete when you yourself are persecuted, but once you're in ascendancy, it becomes an abstract principle when your sacred ideas, so to speak, are being attacked and you feel under threat.
I wonder if there's perhaps a more charitable interpretation of what happens. I mean, one of the things you cover in your book is the Russian episode with Catherine the Great, who had some sympathy for the idea of free speech, and she was an Enlightenment figure in many ways. But you quote Radishev, who was a bit of a dissident, perhaps, at that time, as saying, you know, in whose head can there be more incongruities than that of a czar? And yeah, she took exception to that. But it seemed to me that it's almost a sympathetic thing to say, because if you're Catherine the Great, you're presiding over this massive and unstable political entity. She didn't have any experience of liberal democracy or what that would look like, and she, as far as she was concerned, the alternative to her imperial power might have been anarchy and chaos. So perhaps, you know, we could look at some of these people at least as having a genuine concern that if you allow people to say just anything, it could result in catastrophe.
No, I think these sort of enlightened absolutists that you had with both Frederick and Catherine the Great, I actually think they demonstrate the very intimate link between democracy, or at least representative government, and free speech. That, you know, I think she had good intentions, Catherine. So she thought that, well, free speech to a certain extent will further progress in my realms, but you cannot question my absolute authority to rule. And those things, those two concepts just don't go hand in hand. Mm. So in that sense, you know, and the same with Frederick the Great, like he was, because he was not a very religious figure to say the least, he would allow, you know, Voltaire and others to say just about anything about a religion, but there were clear limits. You couldn't criticize him personally as a ruler. And whereas in democracies, you need that, you know, criticism of those who rule, because they rule in the name of the people and the people are sovereign. It's just inherent. You can't have democracy without that. But I, as I said, you know, I think for most of, in many ways, free speech is probably counterintuitive to human beings, you know, as we evolved. Maybe it wouldn't have been great if you were sort of a hunter-gatherer and you sit around, everyone would have a discussion on, you know, who goes out hunting today and do we really want to do whatever we want to do?
Maybe we should become vegetarians.
Exactly. And you needed sort of maybe strict hierarchies and so on. And so you couldn't just allow anyone to say anything. And that served humanity really well for a long time. But, you know, as we... If you want individual freedom, if you want representative government, then it becomes, you know, you have these clashing ideals that clashes with basic tenets, perhaps, of human nature, evolved yeah. over a very long time, and that becomes difficult to reconcile. And so I think all of us have a tendency towards wanting to censor others.
So one of the pet theories that we have on this Free Kiwis podcast has been that the woke left, for the lack of a better term, has basically become more censorious because the left has come into cultural power in various ways, for example, in the universities. And, you know, if you go back to the 1950s, the boot was on the other foot and the right was enjoying this cultural ascendancy. So then through the 50s and the 60s and 70s, even into the 90s when I was a kid, you know, it was really the left that was more in favor of free speech. So is the fact that this particular left now seems to have turned against free speech, is that just a product of them succeeding? And that once you succeed and get into certain types of power, you then, as a human being, just have a propensity to want to shut others up?
I think that's part of it. It's probably also with a shift in where I think something which, on the one hand, should be lauded, sort of a genuine concern about minorities and persecuted groups that obviously reflect some deep injustices historically, but then sort of coming to the conclusion that free speech and equality are values that are perhaps mutually exclusive, at least at the extreme end of the exercise. Free speech, whereas in the book I argue that free speech and equality are values that are mutually reinforcing. Mm-hmm. But if you truly believe that free speech entrenches unequal power relations, then it becomes logical to want to sort of redistribute power through restricting free speech for one group and prioritizing the concerns of other groups. But I think, you know, power relations plays into it. Once you have that power, you want to exercise it. So obviously the left is no less immune to that than any other group that has gained power. But I think, you know, I still think that there are so many hard progressive leftism free speech restrictions. There are so many built-in internal contradictions that it becomes much more difficult to uphold, whereas sort of traditional conservative venerance for authority is easier to construct a speech repressive regime, I think.
Yeah, one of the interesting things I think about the sort of contemporary attacks on free speech is that they come from people who purport to be defending minorities and defending the oppressed and so on. Whereas historically, I think your analysis shows that restrictions on free speech are much more often coming from the position of defending established power.
Yeah.
But I wonder whether that's really the case in terms of the contemporary threat, or whether it is defending established power, but disguising it as as defense of the oppressed.
Like I said, I think it's probably a mix of both. I think that those who've, like, for instance, if you go to a university and they limit academic freedom based on the idea that they want to protect minorities, I think that they genuinely believed that before they came into power and dominated a university. But then once you come into power, you might stretch that belief and use those justifications to limit free speech also in order to cement your own power. And the problem, of course, is that, you know, so Christianity starts off as a fringe sect that is being persecuted on and off in the Roman Empire. Then it becomes the state religion of the Roman Empire, and suddenly Christianity is persecuting not only pagans but also non-Orthodox Christians. Socialists are being hounded around Europe, very much so also in Tsarist Russia. But the first thing that they do, the communists, the Bolsheviks, when in power, is to abolish press freedom. So that shows that, you know, even if you belong to a persecuted group, you know, if you're allowed to limit free speech once you're empowered, then, you know, you're not sort of equalizing power relationships. You're inverting them through free speech restrictions and ultimately just creating new hierarchies where those who were the persecuted risk becoming the persecutors.
It seems to me that it's worth making the ancient Greek distinction between parhesia and isagoria in this regard, because the idea of parhesia on its own seems perfectly compatible with using free speech in an elitist way or in an elitist sense. You can define it as only for the elites, and that only they have parhesia, you know, the right to say, to speak freely. Whereas isagoria, the equality of speech, that's a, you know, from reading your book, that didn't seem to come back after ancient Athens until, say, Thomas Paine put it down in the Rights of Man, or maybe some of those earlier movements like the Levellers foreshadowed that. But that seems a more advanced version of free speech than parhesia.
Well, it'd be interesting to hear your perspective of that, James. But I think that both isagoria and parhesia are sort of embodiments of a commitment to equality and freedom that were important ideals of Athenian democracy. I think parhesia is important because it's basically a cultural trait. It's basically a commitment to social dissent, which would allow even sort of the lowborn also to voice their opinions. And whereas isagoria is limited to the assembly, so it's basically political.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's the story I've told and a couple of things I've written about it. That isagoria is really something that you find associated with formal political institutions.
Yeah.
So there's the right of the citizens to have equal speech. Yeah. And
it's the exercise of direct democracy, basically, right?
That's right, yeah. So the citizens are formally isoi, they're equal, and they have isonomia, equality before the law, and they have isagoria, equality of public speech, speech in these political institutions. Yeah. Parhesia seems to be something very much wilder than that. So it's associated quite strongly with dramatic festivals, so the kind of ribald comedies of Aristophanes. Yeah. And just as you say, also, parhesia seems to be associated with this idea that you can have a say even though there's some kind of power above you. So we find it in a lot of texts, including tragedies, where people come across, you know, mythical kings, because Greek tragedies often refer to kind of a bygone age, and they say, oh, do I have parhesia? Can I speak in front of this higher-up person? And fascinatingly, it also applies to, in Platonic dialogues, people who are more kind of oligarchically inclined, they sometimes say to Socrates and his friends, ooh, I'm not sure I can say this. Mm. People like Callicles and Thrasymachus, who have very strongly anti-democratic views. And so what they seem to be fearing there is the democratic opinion of the masses. Yeah. And so then they say, can I have parhesia in this situation? So parhesia works there too.
And you see it, you know, Critias, when he sort of justifies the extreme measures of the 30 tyrants where they sort of put people to death. You have these death lists, basically, of Democrats. And he says sort of, you know, oh, you're complaining that we're killing too many people. Well, that's what you have to do when the ordinary people have been reared in freedom for too long.
That's right.
You know, you just have to snuff him out. So that suggests that, you know, it's both isagoria but also parhesia. You can't allow them to speak too freely, even in, you know, in the marketplace or outside the assembly.
Okay, so, well, this actually brings us into another topic we wanted to go into quite well, which is sort of, I suppose, the limits of free speech is one way of putting it, but
also where free speech ultimately resides. So
yeah, and how to protect it, really, because you might think, okay, the way to protect free speech is to bring in constitutional safeguards, sort of clear laws, which then really kind of limit the popular will. Or on the other hand, you might think, no, free speech goes hand in hand, as you say, with equality, with the perception of people as equal. So let's just trust the demos, trust the masses to be the sort of bearers of a kind of civic consciousness that free speech is important. So from your history of free speech, because you've looked at the whole global history of free speech, which one of these do you think is the more promising? Should we have institutional safeguards to make sure that we protect against mob rule, which can sometimes overwhelm free speech? Or should we have really good sort of civic education to make sure everyone is really behind free speech?
I think we need both. And I think that's the genius of Madison, really. James Madison, who drafted the First Amendment, who has a very clear understanding of a much more egalitarian conception of free speech that will ultimately win credence in the US, as opposed to the more elitist British conception of free speech. So the trial of Socrates is a good example of where even if you have a culture and institutions committed to free speech, if someone under the right quote unquote circumstances violates the deepest convictions of the majority, then it can actually devolve into mob rule, and there was no First Amendment or the like that could protect Socrates from his fate, even if he goaded his jurors into basically forcing them to find him guilty, and even into, you know, he could probably have escaped the death penalty, but sort of went all in. So I think that you need both, but I think that if you don't have a strong, robust culture of free speech, then ultimately the legal limits are likely to be, even if you have the strong legal protections on free speech on paper, are unlikely to be applied in a speech protective manner unless you have a critical mass of the population that is committed to robust free speech.
That seems right to me. And you give the historical examples, both of the American First Amendment and of the French Revolutionary Constitution, both of which enshrined free speech, but both of which were violated within 2 or 3 years of being put in place by the very same people who wrote that constitution.
Sure, but so that's true. So in the US, like, the First Amendment was ratified in 1791, and by 1798 you had the passage of the Alien and Sedition Act, and the Sedition Act is signed by John Adams and his Federalist Party, and it protects the President and Congress, all dominated by Federalists, and the oppositions are the Democratic Republicans, James Madison and Thomas Jefferson, principally. So you have this generation, the founding generation, who had agreed that, you know, free speech was the bulwark of liberty when fighting the British, and suddenly they're sort of divided over the limits of free speech. And then in France, you know, I think there's a reason why the French Revolution and its disagreements over the limits of free speech become much more violent than the clashes in America. In America, you'd had a culture of free speech since going back to the early 18th century, especially after a trial called the Sanger case, where a jury in New York refused to find a printer guilty. And since then, it became almost impossible to have anyone convicted for seditious libel in jury cases. And that sort of enshrined a culture, more robust culture of free speech in the US. But in France, revolutionary France comes basically from very elaborate pre- and post-publication censorship system that was somewhat weakened for a small elite of philosophers towards the end, but there wasn't an equivalent to the robust culture of free speech. And so the different classes of strata of French society could not agree on where the limits were, and it sort of ended up deciding it by guillotine. So I think that demonstrates the need for a culture of free speech.
You quote Leonard Hand, the American jurist, and I'm paraphrasing him, but basically it seemed that his view was that free speech as a cultural value was the paramount thing.
It has to reside in the hearts of men, and then, you know, no constitution is
going to protect it otherwise.
Yeah, and if it doesn't rest there, then you know, no constitution can protect it. And you know, George Orwell says much the same. He says, you know, if people are interested in free speech, there will be free speech even if the law doesn't protect it. And if people are not interested in free speech, inconvenient minorities will be persecuted even if the law protects it. So I think, and of course, John Stuart Mill, also, you know, on liberty is very much about society, Victorian society's imposition of norms on dissenters, which he views you know, tyranny of majority as being as much of a danger as the tyranny of the magistrate. So there's a long history, I would say, of viewing, you know, society's tendencies to limit free speech through intolerance as dangerous as legal limits on free speech.
This mention of, you know, tolerance, it might be a good time to discuss Karl Popper's paradox of tolerance.
Written here, right?
Written here in New Zealand during World War II when he was a refugee.
Yeah.
We've had a little bit of debate with Jonathan about this, and James has actually done some work with Brian Boyd, who's a New Zealand scholar of Popper, on this. So do you want to
it kind of goes into this question of, you know, once we've decided to sort of instill in the people a sense of free speech, where do we set the bounds? Or even if we want to set up a constitutional safeguard for free speech, where do we set the bounds? And I think that there's a notorious cartoon which has gone around social media purporting to sort of show Popper's view on this. And it seems like they would have Popper as saying, you know, anybody who expresses intolerant ideas, we should be intolerant of that. But if you go deeper, and Brian Boyd and I have done this, if you go deeper into Popper's writings, it seems like Popper actually had a very high bar for what he saw as intolerance in that situation. And it was basically people who were willing to use violence. So political movements who were intent on undermining democracy through violence, and chiefly, of course, obviously, considering because of his personal history, Popper had in mind there the Nazis. Yeah. Although he was also concerned about the far left as well. I mean, he had some experience of that in Vienna. So this is actually kind of a classical liberal thing, I think, that Popper is continuous with maybe some other people like Mill and perhaps Berlin, that they place the limits of free speech at actual violence. And they sort of say that's really the moment when you have to stop, or, you know, it's clear incitement to violence.
Yeah, so in that very famous passage about you know, how tolerance of intolerance will lead to the destruction of tolerance, it's accompanied by a footnote where he sort of says that, you know, this should only be applied to, you know, if you can basically reach people through argument, that's the preferred method, and it should only be in exceptional cases. I don't know, you know, you've studied his scholarship more than me, but from that passage and from that quote, it doesn't seem to me that he suggests that the limit might necessarily be incitement to violence, but it's clear that he doesn't mean anyone who expresses an intolerant idea should
be. I actually think that he's identified a problem that he didn't know the answer to, ultimately.
And of course, I think the
issue actually is, it comes back to the value base for free speech. And I guess my personal perspective is, in some ways, it's a fairly grim one, because I don't think, like Leonard Hand said, that we can protect it through legal means alone by any means. It's doomed if it's not resident in our value base. Yeah. But there is no way to guarantee it being resident in our value base.
Free speech is an experiment, right? But someone who is much more sort of provides the basis of what we call militant democracy is Karl Löwenstein, who's also a German emigre, a professor of political science and law. And he writes these very influential articles in Columbia. I think he's at Columbia. So he writes these articles on militant democracy, where he basically says that European democracies have been far too lenient towards fascist movements and adopted way too speech protective measures, and that you need to crack down basically on fascist movements. But what he ignores is that in the Weimar Republic, in Germany, there were quite a number of speech restrictions, some of them quite draconian. So heavy censorship of the radio, ability of German states to ban administratively newspapers if they spread false information or attack government. And the Nazis were very frequently targets of that. And I think even more damningly, those emergency measures meant to protect democracy were ultimately used by the Nazis when they came into power to abolish free speech.
You make the point that they actually used that as an argument. They said, "Well, you did it to us." So
yeah, you know, Hitler hosts. You know, there's a social democrat called Otto Wels who argues against Hitler and Hitler. I mean, obviously, if you go back to the earlier speeches of Hitler, it's perfectly clear that he has no time for free speech at all. But it basically gives him whataboutery points, and he says, you know, if you were so happy about free speech, why did you ban me from speaking around the country? Why did you close down our newspapers? And now you come talking about free speech when we want to set our limits. And of course, those limits were quite more draconian than those of liberals and social democrats. But I think, you know, even before the Weimar Republic, you know, if you go back to the days of Bismarck, for instance, he adopted these anti-socialist laws, which threw hundreds of German journalists, socialists and social democrats, into prison and banned socialist and social democratic parties. So I call it the Weimar fallacy because of this history. So the idea that if you want to protect democracy against totalitarian extremist movements, you have to ban certain forms of speech. Now, that doesn't mean that if you don't, you know, if you protect all kinds of speech short of incitement to violence, that democracy is safeguarded. You know, as I said, you know, no one can guarantee the survival of democracy, and you can't guarantee that there won't be a movement that comes into power through democratic means having used speech and will do away with it. But what you can guarantee is that every authoritarian government, the very first thing it will do is to limit free speech.
Yeah. I want to move to the modern day and talk about, you know, how much of a threat is there to free speech right now. But I was interested in reading your chapter on medieval Europe. You have some interesting statistics about the Inquisition. So you talk about this inquisitor, Bernard Guy, and you say of more than 900 sentences of heresy that he handed down, he only handed 42 people over to the authorities to be burnt at the stake. And I read that and I thought, well, that's kind of nice. You know, it's only 42 out of 900, more than 900 sentences. But at the same time, you know, he burned 42 people at the stake. Yeah. So obviously we aren't in that universe anymore, thank goodness. We're not in the universe where we're burning people at the stake. However, there's often this argument in the modern day, you know, that we point out instances of people being deplatformed at universities or occasionally academics losing their jobs. And the response is often, yeah, okay, that's like a piffling figure of like 3 or 4 academics, you know, 5 or 6 deplatformings. What's the big deal? And I think that, you know, in the medieval case, obviously, this is probably a very strong effect. In the modern case, you might have a similar effect. There's also this chilling effect, right? Yeah. There's also this thing that I haven't been burned at the stake, but I could see that this other guy who had heretical ideas or had, you know, free thinking about Jesus or the Bible ended up like that. So I'm not going to take a risk. And similarly, even though, you know, there's great differences, in the modern academy, it might be something like, well, you know, I'm probably not going to lose my job, but I just want to be safe because I know that that one other guy did.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right in that it'll have a, it's the same, like if you go to Saudi Arabia, you might say, well, maybe, I don't know the exact figure, but maybe only 2 people in the last decade were executed for blasphemy. So does that mean that Saudi Arabia is a moderate country when it comes to blasphemy of Islam? Of course not. It just means that the risk is there and you're not going to take that chance. And of course, like someone like Ben Agui, there were other punishments. So they would put you in prison on remand basically for years and years. They would in some cases use torture. And what they would do is shame you publicly by sort of giving you prominent symbols that you should wear as a heretic walking around in public that would show you as a danger to community as a heretic. So I think it was just important to sort of, there have been these tropes that sort of both the Spanish Inquisition and the medieval Inquisition would burn all heretics, and that just is not true. But that doesn't mean that some of the other less draconian punishments weren't very effective in clamping down on heretical views. And you know, even though I don't think we should take the analogy from the medieval Inquisition into the limits being put on academic freedom today too far, then obviously if you see someone whose career is being ruined or is being disciplined by university administration, then that is likely to dampen the willingness of a lot of other colleagues to say something controversial.
There are a lot of different levels to it, aren't there? And it does come back to the extent to which free speech is held as a value in a culture. If you have, even if you have no fear of legal sanction or even losing your job or something like that, if you live in a culture where free speech is not valued, you find yourself a pariah, potentially, yeah, and that has a strong effect on human psychology.
It's interesting. Nick Cave, of all people, actually wrote something really interesting about cancel culture, where he said it's bad religion run amok. In his sort of blog, The Red Hand Files, he wrote something very perceptive, I thought, about cancel culture, and quite eloquent. And so that is that analogy, even though, of course, again, the consequences for the individual academic who might dissent from whatever orthodoxy is prevalent at their institution will not suffer the same consequences as someone who deviated from.
But the effect might nonetheless be the same, to kind of stamp out.
Sure.
Free exchange of ideas.
Sure. Though, of course, you know, it would probably take a lot more bravery to stand up against Bernard Guy in the medieval period than it would take to stand up against orthodoxy by your university administrators.
Well,
or
you would think.
From which we can only conclude that the modern academy are such terrible cowards.
Yeah, but on the other hand, you know, there are, you know, great institutions and others who've sort of rallied against this tendency. So there is pushback against it. It's something that is being discussed, debated, which would probably have been very difficult to write something against Bernard Guy and get away with it.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, we're aware that you have limited time today because you're very busy fighting the good fight, speaking around New Zealand. So we'll end there. We'll just say thank you so much for joining us and best wishes with the rest of your tour.
Thank you. It was an absolute pleasure.